This week's episode of Powder Keg is brought to you by DeveloperTown. By leveraging their years of experience working with startups, DeveloperTown is able to help companies better understand the viability of potential software solutions and quickly bring them to market. DeveloperTown has created proven sprint-to-market processes so large enterprises can move like a startup. You can find out more at developertown.com/powderkeg. Again, that's developertown.com/powderkeg. DeveloperTown, start something.
I think the thing that we didn't quite pull off was having the revenue model figured out early on. And the combination of that and having that outside investment left us a little bit vulnerable. And so when the market turned a little bit and banks got a little bit scared, there just wasn't enough to convince them that this was something to continue investing in. And we all took that lesson absolutely to heart.
That's Clint Smith, sharing some of his experiences working at a tech startup in the late 90s, early 2000s, right around the time of the dot-com boom and bust. So those very experiences shaped this tech leader's entrepreneurial journey and the unconventional way that he's building his company. Clint is the co-founder and CEO of Emma, an email marketing software as a service company based in Nashville, Tennessee. And coming up on this episode of Powder Keg, I talk with Clint about the lessons he's learned as he grew Emma to more than 200 employees and $20 million in annual revenue before raising outside venture capital. In this conversation with Clint, you'll learn the unexpected way Emma recently grew their product engagement, brand awareness, and sales, why Clint waited to raise outside venture capital until after Emma reached $20 million in annual revenue, and some of the unique approaches to relationships that have completely catapulted his business and career. I'm your host, Matt Hunkler, and you're listening to episode 29 of Powder Keg Igniting Startups, a show for entrepreneurs, leaders, and innovators who are building remarkable tech companies in areas decidedly outside of Silicon Valley. I've been spending a lot of time lately in Nashville, Tennessee, where there's a lot more going on than bachelorette parties and honky-tonk. See, Music City has a vibrant startup and tech ecosystem emerging from a number of industries, especially healthcare and, of course, music technology. But as I met more of the tech leaders and investors in Nashville, one name kept coming up: Emma. That's E-M-M-A. And Emma, of course, is not a person, but rather a tech company that's absolutely killing it with offices in Nashville and now Portland, Oregon, and team members all over the country. I was lucky enough to connect with Emma's co-founder and CEO, Clint Smith, who called me from Nashville to share what he's learned while growing his company from outside Silicon Valley in a competitive industry that's just exploding. And one of the most compelling things that Emma has done to grow their customer base and brand reputation in this industry is host their own marketing conference. Here's Clint.
Clint, thank you so much for taking time to dial in. Where are you calling in from right now?
I'm calling in from scenic Nashville, Tennessee, Matt.
I love it. I have been spending a lot of time in Nashville recently, as you know. There is just a really, really cool city in terms of tech and the scene that you've got there. Your company being a big piece of the ecosystem that's built up in Nashville. I know you just coming off the heels now of your annual conference, which had, did I get this right, almost 1,000 people there?
That's exactly right. It became a bit of a thing this year. This is our third year hosting Marketing United, and the idea in the beginning when we started this was to do something that was bigger than a user conference. Although we love our customers, and that's a big part of the three-day event, we wanted to put up a bigger tent and welcome marketers of all stripes and all types of organizations, whether they work with us today or not. And so we were very fortunate to host about 900 marketers to town just a few weeks ago down the hill from our offices at this beautiful facility at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and just sort of filled with character and tremendous theater as sort of the centerpiece stage, and just a phenomenal experience. And we brought in some speakers from around the country, attached to great brands like Netflix and Pixar and Nike, and just had 3 days of amazing learning and connecting and food and beverage and all that good stuff that happens at events. And we wanted this to be the kind of conference that we would attend. So no stuffy ballrooms, no stale chicken plates, just a really fun, warm, friendly experience.
Well, it sounds like a blast. And our friend Jay Baer, who's been on the podcast before, I was following his Snapchat stories and Instagram stories from down there, and I was having some serious FOMO, I got to tell you.
Jay has been with us all 3 years. What a great guy. And this year stepped up into the MC role and did a phenomenal job. So he's running out of room here. I don't know what he graduates to next to market, but he's part of the team at this point. It's great.
He's the best MC you could ask for. I'm jealous. I'm jealous of the experience, but I will plan on getting there next year. It's open to more than just customers. Talk to me about why you're a software company. Why would you host a conference that's not a user conference or something focused on just generating sales?
Well, the sales team will tell you having 50% of the attendees not be customers today is an amazing thing. Right? There's plenty of work left for them to do after the event. But we just wanted to do something bigger than ourselves. We love playing host. We certainly love welcoming a lot of Emma customers into the mix. And in fact, the first day of the event is a day-long customer-only pre-conference event. So that is where we can sort of put the walls up and say, okay, you're all here as Emma customers, part of our community. Let's do some workshops. Let's really deep dive on how you can make the most of the software and of the experience. And then we throw the doors a little bit wider for the next 2 days. And I think part of it was we had sort of waited a while to host a conference. We've been in business, obviously, a lot longer than just the last 3 years. And so by the time we got around to this idea, we said, well, let's go big. We've got some pent-up ambition around this. And we just like the idea of, again, making it bigger than Emma, making it bigger than us, and making it more about great marketing and just a gathering place for marketers from all over the country. We have a few marketers from other countries as well, so there's an international element to it. And we want to do something significant for not just Emma, but for Nashville and for the Southeast. There aren't a lot of great marketing events in this part of the country and in between the coast. And so we wanted to just plant a really big flag and make it a true community gathering, more about marketing than whether or not you happen to use the Emma product.
You mentioned that the sales team has some follow-ups to do. I assume you'll be closing business out of the conference, which is obviously a great reason to be putting the conference on. Can you talk to me about some of the other benefits of putting on a conference? You know, I imagine there's a lot of founders that are contemplating the idea of doing some sort of a user conference or industry conference that could help position them. But obviously, there's only so many things you can focus on. I'm curious, what are the benefits and why did you decide to go all in on this beyond just the sales?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, obviously, it is first and foremost a way to engage our customers. And so we certainly want to build around the existing customer base. And something really incredible happens when you take a large group of folks who you have relationships with largely over email and largely over the phone, and you know them by name, but you haven't really had a chance to see them, you know, in person and to connect with them sort of live. And an amazing thing happens when you bring not just 2 or 3 or 10 of those folks, but hundreds of them into a single space and spend a few days with them. And it's incredible. We've always hung our hat on providing a really good brand experience and taking really good care of people. And to have them show up in a room with us and largely go out of their way to shake our hands and pat us on the back and say how thrilled they are to be part of the Emma community, it's just incredible. Of course, we're just humbled by the whole thing and want to go out and be the first to shake their hands and tell them how much we appreciate them being part of this with us and to ask them what we can do better. In fact, one of the several opportunities we had to do that and get a little bit closer to customers and really figure out what's on their minds was at the start of the that first day that was for customers only. We brought a select group of customers over to the Emma offices, and about 15 folks, and had essentially what we call a customer advisory board session, where our head of product, Jeff, did a phenomenal job walking them through our vision for the product roadmap for the next, you know, several quarters, and then said, hey, so if this sounds interesting, we've brought in all of our product managers. They're stationed around the room. They've got large-scale printouts of some of the features and capabilities that we're in the process of designing and building. Here's 1,000 Emma bucks, 1,000 fake dollars and hundreds. Walk around, spend time with the product managers, see what their vision is, see what they're up to, and spend your money where you see the most value. And you can spend $1,000 in one place, all on data and analytics. You can spread the love around and spend $500 there and $500 on team collaboration tools. You can go into cross-channel. You can do whatever you want. And they did that, and they came back into as a group and talked through their choices and where they invested, quote-unquote, their Emma dollars. And just what a fun way to engage with some really meaningful customers that not only – got a lot of great feedback, but I think sent them home with a good story. Wow, how cool was that, that the Emma team pulled us into a room and allowed us to have fun for a couple of hours.
That's a really cool idea and definitely a much more fun way to do your classic focus group. So I love that idea.
Right. The stale sort of corporate room with the drop ceilings and the two-way mirror, like, you know, it's yep. just Yeah, it brings a certain ritual to.
You forgot the bowl of M&Ms that no one touches.
That's right.
Yeah, I might have to steal that idea from you. I love that. That is really, really cool. You're almost putting them in this future state, not only getting your customers excited about what's coming, but getting that feedback loop of, hey, this is what our customers will actually spend money on, you know, not just Emma Bucks.
That's exactly right. And it builds excitement for them. It builds a ton of excitement for us and our team. And again, imagine if you're on the customer support team at Emma and 99% of your interactions with people happen over the phone or through email. And now all of a sudden you get to stand next to somebody who you might have had 20 or 30 conversations with over the last couple of years. And here they are up close. And it's great. And we carry that momentum into the next 12 months. You walk out of the event with customers fired up, right? Which is huge. So from an engagement standpoint, from a growth and retention standpoint, it's pretty phenomenal. You walk away with content, right, that you can use over the next 12 months. So you've got great video content from all of the amazing speakers who show up, and you can kind of feed that out back out into the community and use that in a bunch of different ways from a content marketing standpoint. So that's good. And then you further those relationships so that even if we didn't have somebody into that specific customer advisory board group or to dinner, because there's so many opportunities to pull smaller groups from the bigger community out to just socialize and get to know each other better. You've established deeper relationships with so many people, and now those product managers know them, and they can call them in a few weeks and say, hey, that thing that we talked about, we're close to launching it. Can I get some feedback from you? And so just at a relationship level alone, it's pretty tremendous. It is no small undertaking, right? As folks who've done this know, events are an entirely different thing, and the first couple of years, it takes a while to figure out how to do it, how much to invest in speakers versus ticket sales. There's a lot there, and our team has done a phenomenal job to do that 3 years in a row. But we would certainly recommend it when you feel like you've got a little bit of a critical mass of community around you. Bringing people into a shared space is awesome. And if most of your customers are local or that's where you start, even better. I think that's one of the things that we learned was we did wait a while. And in hindsight, I would have done that a little bit sooner. And so, you know what, even if we can't afford to bring in, you know, paid speakers right away, even if we can't afford to, we can't charge enough to sort of make it sort of pay off, or we aren't comfortable enough sort of reaching out sort of nationally first, let's just grab our local customers and have them over for a mini event and a dinner and keep it super casual and on the cheap and just get in the game. And I think that's there are easy ways to step into this. Even now, we're looking to fill the space between the big events and take Emma on the road a little bit and have many sort of learning sessions and social hours / dinners, do a little customer advisory board session with the local customers in that city ahead of time, and just recreate smaller versions of this that ultimately don't take a ton of time or effort to put on, but can accomplish some of the same goals.
Well, obviously, I'm a huge believer in the power of events. You know, we'll host over 30 events this year throughout the Verge and Powder Keg Network. And one of the things that we've been playing with is this idea of an annual conference. And it's something we've done in the past, but now that we've got a bigger network geographically, the idea of bringing this back is really compelling, and I think, you know, ultimately will happen. But I'm curious to know what you've learned in these past 3 years. So you've done this three times now, you know, almost 1,000 people at this last one. What were some of the mistakes that you made in year one and year two that you've learned from and now implemented some new solutions or a different approach?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing we got right from the start was we wanted to make this again a little bit unique. We wanted to be small scale, as big as it may ultimately be over time, and we wanted it to be warm and friendly and fun. And our team paid attention to a lot of details right from the start, right? Whether it's the space we chose to put it in, the dinners sort of after sort of the day sessions, and could we go somewhere fun for that? The wrap party that happens at the end of all of it back up at our offices, and could we curate that with really good beer and beverages and really good food?
Is that a wrap party WRAP or RAP?
Now, there might have been karaoke involved in the conference. It's a separate outing. But no, the final event did not have me or anyone else rapping with
something,
an R.
Something to add for next year.
That's right. That's one of the mistakes we've made. We didn't have enough rapping at the final rap party. So I think that's the one thing we got right. A lot of the other things we absolutely learned along the way. In the first couple of years, well, in the first year, we had a slightly smaller group, several hundred folks there, maybe 300 or 400. And you realize that it's one thing to have everybody in the theater for your keynotes. But the minute you break those up into sessions and you have two or three competing sessions at once, you've got to make sure that you can fill those rooms. And we didn't have enough people in some cases, right, where all three breakout sessions would have full rooms. And if you don't have a full room, it lessens the experience for the speaker, obviously, as well as the crowd, right? Because you're looking around wondering, well, gosh, you know, why aren't there more people here? Why isn't this more compelling than it is? Maybe this isn't compelling. So that's one thing we learned. It's just the numbers game matters a lot when you're trying to create that sense of energy for the crowd and for the person on stage. And so we tried to, you know, work on that the last couple of years. Some of the panels and some of the sessions we got wrong, and they just didn't have a big enough draw. We had one this last time that was music industry focused. And you realize if you're going to put that up against a broader, you know, digital marketing session, you've got to be really careful and make sure you've got enough folks in the audience who care. And not only that, when you pair a topic that might not be broadly appealing with something like a fireside chat format, then I think that also tends to give people pause and say, gosh, is that really going to be a worthwhile conversation to watch, as opposed to a presentation from a thought leader where I feel like regardless, I'm going to walk away with some really, really good nuggets. So the format of the sessions we've tweaked, the spacing of things, and what do you sort of pit against each other, right, in terms of those breakouts happening at the same time. Another thing that we've worked on is how much of a presence for us to have. And I think we were a little bit sensitive to that the first couple of years. Didn't want to, again, sort of make this so much about Emma that it was off-putting to folks who were there for different reasons. This year, I think we hit on a happy medium where we took a session for ourselves on the main stage about product roadmap and where we see not just Emma going, but email marketing and digital marketing a little bit more broadly going. The best compliment we've gotten, even with the occasional hiccup along the way, is just how impressed people are by the friendliness of our team and everybody there who's volunteering or helping out or speaking. And I think that goes a long way in terms of having people overlook the little gaffes that they might experience.
It sounds like you guys did this all internally and didn't hire an outside event coordinator. Is that correct?
It's mostly correct. The only outside firm we worked with, we worked with a couple of outside speaker agencies, right? So when it came time to look for speakers and figure out kind of who people had access to in their rosters, we worked with some outside firms. They're still managed by our team. And then we used an outside firm for some of the logistics. So there's a local group here that helps us with things like securing and negotiating the hotel room block deal. And then ultimately coordinating with the venue, in this case, the Country Music Hall, on AV and other logistical details. So those are the folks who run deep on the details ahead of time, and then certainly a lot of the details over the course of 3 days. But in terms of putting the event on, in terms of selling tickets, in terms of the marketing, in terms of building that speaker roster, in terms of putting the whole thing on from start to finish, that has largely been our team's work.
Wow. Huge undertaking, but probably pays off in dividends when you talk about having it be a brand experience that truly communicates the culture of Emma in everything that you do, even if your brand isn't slapped on the front of it at all times for every single thing. Just those interactions with Emma employees probably is a great experience that has and will continue to pay dividends for you guys.
It really does. And you're exactly right that it's partly about, you know, the customers and the attendees, right, and the excitement it builds for them. It is also very much about our own employees, right? When they get to see the energy and the strength and size of the community that we're building and to really experience it up close, it is something that I think gets them more fired up than ever. It's not unlike when we first advertised on NPR nationally. The first people who got fired up were our own employees. Wow, we're advertising nationally. This is fantastic. Like, this is a big deal. So I think everybody walks away with a lot of excitement. It's great. And for us, like, it matters a ton because we say that Marketing United, this one event a year, this one moment, is our brand experience come to life in a crazy, unique way. That's the experience that we want to bring to life every single day, all 12 months of the year, right? Not just the big moment where it all comes together like this. And so for us to be able to point to that and say those things we care about, extra friendly with our customers, really going out the extra mile to take care of them, make sure they have what they need, make sure they're feeling successful, all of that good stuff at a software level, at a service and services level, it just makes tons of sense for us to host that kind of event to really put an exclamation point on it.
the fact that it continues to grow every year has got to give you some reassurance as a CEO that this is something to continue to invest in and something to continue to make core part of what you're doing. To your point, it is something big. I mean, the last numbers I saw, you guys have almost 200 employees and 20 million in annual revenue, or north of 20 million. Is that correct?
We are in the northern territory of all that and growing nicely. And you're right, close to 200 people on staff. A lot of folks are here in the Nashville headquarters, just in a part of downtown called SoBro, and a couple of renovated old brick warehouses, just an awesome space as part of a development called the Trolley Barns here in Nashville. We have a small office in Portland, Oregon, where we have a customer service team, a small part of the bigger customer service effort. And we have some of our marketing team, and we have some of our engineering team. What a great place to find engineers in addition to Nashville. And then we have folks a little bit scattered around the country from there.
That's really cool. And I really want to dive into how you decided to grow that way geographically. But one thing I think is most interesting to me is the way that you have bootstrapped this thing. And I know you've taken on some venture funding the last couple of years, somewhere around $5 million in venture the last couple of years. But prior to that, you pretty much bootstrapped this whole thing with your co-founder. Is that right?
That's right. Will and I started work on the Emma idea back in 2002, and really didn't exactly know what we were going to do. We knew we were going to do something, and when the idea finally struck, to say, like, hey, let's take these things that we care about, namely really good product design, really good graphic design that brands can use, particularly smaller companies, to really play up and look great in front of their audience, and then a holistic customer and brand experience that's really standout. We started looking at the email marketing landscape, felt like those things would stand out at that time, and started working on it. And we were, you know, coming off of another company and said, you know what, we're confident enough to launch out on our own, but maybe not confident enough to take other people's money, right? So let's get really creative. Let's get really crafty. Let's do some other project work, right, to help fund this thing. And that's what we did for a while. And then in 2003, when it reached a point where it said, okay, well, you know, this is kind of turning into something, we probably need a little bit of help. We need to hire a couple of employees to help out. We were fortunate enough to get a bank loan for that, and that became our startup capital. And that was enough to kind of power us through to the point where we were cash flow break even about a year and a half later. And from that point, we were happily growing as an independent and profitable and largely debt-free company for a good long while, and really enjoyed that chapter of life. And then, as you said, a couple of years ago, said, you know what, that's been great, but there's a ton of opportunity out in the market. We'd love to accelerate beyond our own means and go a little bit faster. And if we're going to do that, probably means a little bit more capital than we have access to. And meanwhile, we'd always had a number of investors in Nashville eager to join us and be part of the story, and ultimately to be part of the MS success that we're pulling for, and that ultimately Nashville, I think, is pulling for as a city, as a community. And so we said, you know what, feels like a good time to take advantage of that, and let's do that. So we worked with a group called Nashville Capital Network that brings its own fund and essentially a collection of angel investors who can invest individually on top of the fund, and did that and raised about $3.5 million in the form of a convertible note. And then the other part of that five was just a move of our line of credit from a local bank to a bank called Square One out of North Carolina. And we've loved working with those guys. And so that's become the fresh round of capital to help us accelerate into this next chapter and, you know, beef up the team and beef up sales and continue to invest heavily in product and do all those things that you typically do with a little bit of investment capital. And so it's been a lot of fun, and we now get to be cheered on in an even more meaningful way by people scattered around the Nashville, you know, investor community and technology community. And that's been a lot of fun.
Well, and I want to dive into that in just a second, because I think the fact that you were able to raise that capital locally, but as well as getting some outside funding, is interesting and unique, and I'd love to better understand how you did that. But first, I would love to ask you, you mentioned you had previously had some experience with some other companies. I know that Emma was not your first rodeo in the online space. Can you talk to me a little bit about the experience, or maybe one of the experiences that most informed your approach with growing Emma?
Absolutely. My second job out of college was with a company called City Search. And City Search at the time, this was in the sort of mid-90s, was building out offices around the country and creating city guides, online city guides, basically that were meant to be kind of the premier destination where you would go in that city and figure out what's going on and get to know businesses and sort of navigate your way through that city online. And Nashville happened to be one of the early cities that City Search, created an office in. They went to tier two cities on purpose out of their LA/Pasadena headquarters. And they came to Nashville, and I lucked out and got a job with them. It was sort of on the sales side to start, and then very quickly moved over into the editorial side of the house, and ultimately became editor of the Nashville Guide, essentially. And it was, City Search was great because these were the early days, right, of the internet startups, and it was kind of that stereotypical West Coast company where there were no real offices, everything was out in the open. Founders, execs, leaders had desks just like everybody else, and all of the desks were made of old refurbished doors plopped down on top of filing cabinets.
Very Jeff Bezos.
Right, exactly. And so it was my first exposure to, and I had come from a healthcare company my first job out of college, so old school healthcare company. So you can imagine the culture shock in a great way of going from drop ceilings and cubicle farms to this crazy new world of wide open spaces and high energy and collaboration and sort of flatness and all of that. City Search showed me a lot about how to design not just a team, but also a space in which that team has a chance to thrive. And so I took a lot of cues away from City Search. And then Will and I met at a startup here in Nashville called smallbusiness.com and had about a 2-year run before we moved on to Emma. And whereas I'd had a chance to see City Search from a satellite office, with a little bit of time in home office, small business gave me a chance to be right in the heart of it, right? And to see a company grow from nothing to a really good product and a team of 30 or 40 people doing really good stuff. And it sort of showed me a different flavor of the same kind of idea, but more up close. And so I learned a ton from that experience. Will and I both did. And I think without that experience, without my experience at City Search, I don't know that we would have felt comfortable striking out on our own. But we took a lot away from those companies and those groups of people.
I want to dig in a little bit deeper and ask one more question before we take a quick break. What was the biggest failure that you experienced during those two ventures that really gave you one of your biggest insights and takeaways? Because I feel like so often a lot of podcasts focus on the successes and how you raise the money and how you got all the clients and customers, but I feel like there's a lot of lessons to be learned in those failures. Can you think of one failure in particular in those early ventures that you kind of took those battle wounds and used them to your benefit?
Sure. You know, at City Search, I was such a tiny cog in the system. I mean, I was this lowly little, editorial person, and people in editorial companies will understand what I mean in general. But even within that world, like I was just a tiny little sort of speck on the radar. And so I probably didn't see enough of it up close to really understand some of where it might have gone a little bit differently there. When Ticketmaster bought City Search, content, which had been king for a while, stopped being king, and now selling tickets was king. And so that business sort of morphed and moved a little bit, and a lot of the jobs ended up rolling up into regional hubs and out west. And so it was interesting to watch that happen, right? And to see a company eventually think a little bit differently about things that it had once taken very seriously. And so I'm sure that lesson lodged in my head somewhere. With small business, obviously, I was a lot closer to it. And I think the thing that we didn't quite pull off was having the revenue model figured out early on. And the combination of that and having that outside investment left us a little bit vulnerable. And so when the market turned a little bit and banks got a little bit scared, there just wasn't enough to convince them that this was something to continue investing in. And we all took that lesson absolutely to heart. And so when we started Emma, we said, gosh, that was an amazing group of people with an incredible mission and just doing amazing work and forces beyond our control, ultimately, pushing in a very different direction. Let's be very careful, but us as first-time entrepreneurs, people, we've never done any of this before. We've seen it and we've participated in it, but we've never done it ourselves. Let's start out with a revenue plan in mind. Let's get there as quickly as possible. Let's get customers not just telling us they like our idea, but paying us for it. And let's make sure that we're building, if nothing else, a business that is real, that has customers, that has revenue coming in the door and can show us, you know, what the path to sort of growth and success and ultimately profitability. And so that's one of the reasons why we chose the path we did, was we were a product of our times. We saw what could happen, right, if everything doesn't work it out. And most of the times it doesn't, right, for so many of us. And so we were super cognizant of that and very cautious. And so when we started Emma, we said, all right, let's do this one step at a time. Let's work quickly, right, and act as if it's going to work, but let's also gate it. And so every month we had sort of had that next little goal. Well, if we can get the concept prototyped out, that's a good goal. Let's do that. And if we feel good about it, and then let's go and shop that around and get some really good feedback from people. And then let's, you know, make it a working wireframe, and let's build it out a little bit more. And then let's do a little bit more, all of that sort of one step at a time, just trying to prove it out and make sure that this thing that we thought had potential actually did.
I love that concept of gating your goals, and I really appreciate you sharing those lessons learned, because I'm sure that they were not easy lessons to learn at all. So when we come back, I would love to talk a little bit more about those gating goals and how you use some of that to help land the venture capital, both locally in Nashville and from outside firms that invested into Emma and the growth you're experiencing now.
Thanks for listening to Powder Keg Igniting Startups. I wanted to take a minute to make sure you know that this episode is powered by Verge, a network of local communities with global reach for tech entrepreneurs, investors, and top talent outside of Silicon Valley. Verge has hosted more than 1,000 entrepreneurs to pitch their companies at our events around the world in cities like Indianapolis, Indiana, Kansas City, Missouri, and Nashville, Tennessee. Those founders have gone on to raise more than $500 million in capital collectively and are disrupting industries, creating wealth, and changing the world. These are their stories. And if you haven't subscribed to Powder Keg yet, it's not too late. You can subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can find all of the links to subscribe, as well as show notes and transcripts, at our website, powderkeg.com. So that's powderkeg, all one word, .com. And if you have an iTunes account, we created a handy link for you at powderkeg.com/iTunes. That's going to take you directly to our show, where you can subscribe, leave a review, and see all of the awesome episodes from past guests like Brian Clark at Rainmaker, based in Boulder, Colorado, Karen Nortman at Upfront Ventures in Los Angeles, California, and Max Yoder at Lesson Lee in Indianapolis, Indiana. So again, that's powderkeg.com/iTunes. Back to the show.
And we're back with Clint Smith, co-founder of Emma, which has grown in Nashville, Tennessee and beyond. And one of the things we were talking about was the fact that you raised around $5 million in capital, both from local investors as well as out-of-state investors there in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you did, you and your co-founder did, to make sure that you were fundraise ready? And how did you know it was time to pull the trigger and take on some outside capital?
You know, we're such a weird story in that aspect, such an anomaly. You know, as we said earlier, we funded our initial chapter or two of growth with a simple bank loan, a line of credit, and somehow just scraped every, you know, dime and every penny out of that to power through and become a profitable company. And so that was typically right where you would have made the move that we made just really in the past couple of years to bring in some capital and some smart folks attached to it. So the fact that we bootstrapped our way to around that 20 million mark of ARR before we really went out and raised is definitely a very unique thing. So that did a couple things. One of which is, by the time we got to it, we'd had a fairly long history, right? We had a pretty good track record over lots of years. We'd proven time over time that we could grow a business and we could run a business profitably and really manage it well, I think. And we knew, and perhaps more importantly, we knew ourselves. We knew what we wanted. We knew what we didn't want. And we also were again fortunate enough by that point to be a little bit choosy, right, in terms of being invited into the business to help us out.
What did you know you didn't want?
You know, we knew we didn't want jerks. I mean, that's obviously a big part of it. You know, we knew our brand and our sort of chemistry, and I've come to believe that really it all boils down to good chemistry among highly capable people, whether you're talking about your whole team or the leadership team within it, or your board, or your investors. we were super cognizant of the people that we ultimately invited in. And again, the fact that, you know, NCM brought a really good group of folks sort of with that capital was very appealing. I mean, it happened really quickly. I mean, the convertible notes are a really easy structure to work with. And so that all happened within about 45 days. It didn't take that long, which is great that it didn't become a whole other process or distraction alongside running the business. And then, like I said, the other part was really just teaming up with Square One. And Square One, it's just a different model, right? So it was where our traditional banks, which had been great, but really looked to just simply make sure that you had good cash flow and could pay the interest on the loan every month. You know, Square One takes a different approach and realizes that if you're a recurring revenue business, you know, there might be times where you're burning cash on purpose. And they look less to the bottom line in those moments than to the top line and say, all right, as long as you're holding steady, you're growing your MRR line, they're great. And they're more than comfortable giving you access to meaningful capital as a result. And of course, they like to lean in with companies who have that other investor, right? So that they don't, all of the risk isn't falling to them. And so it just worked out that we were able to time those two events together and use the one to secure the other. And so that's been great. And you mentioned it already. One of the big moves we made around the same time was finding our way to Peter McCormick, one of the founders of an enormously successful company there in your backwoods called Exact, right? And Peter was phenomenal. And the way we found our way to Peter, and for everyone out there who fields those calls from potential investors looking to just sort of, you know, suss things out and figure out whether they're a viable, you know, investable story. You know, we have those conversations all the time. And at one point I realized, you know, I need to ask for more in these calls because I can always hear the person frantically typing and collecting every bit of data on us, you know, in the course of a Q&A. And we realized, all right, let's make these calls a little bit more worth our while since we're not really looking for investors most of the time. And these are smart people and they watch the industry just like we do and they know a lot of people. So I started instituting this practice of at the end of a call, when the smart folks will say, like, what can I do to be helpful in this next interim before we talk again? And I started answering it every time with, well, you can connect me with two or three really smart people who you think, based on what you know about us now, could be helpful. One of those folks really took it to heart, came back a week later with three names. They were all fantastic people. They all happened to be in New York. So a colleague and I went up and met with all three of them and had lunch with Peter and somehow convinced him to sign on as an advisor. And really, Peter's the one who leaned in as a personal mentor for me and said, okay, let's figure out what our goals look like over the next few years. Let's figure out maybe where some gaps are in the business, maybe where some gaps are in the team. Let's draw up that sort of design. I know some people who might be able to fill a spot too in that new design, and let's work through this together. And I think that move, apart from the capital, and maybe even more importantly than the capital, was the game changer for us and for me. Teaming up with somebody who had truly seen ahead several levels, had seen around the next four corners, not the next one or two, and is just so open in terms of sharing his experience, his successes, his failures or regrets, just phenomenal. The kind of person where the minute you meet him, like, gosh, why didn't I meet him 4 years earlier? Why didn't I meet him before we started this whole thing? So that kind of impact on us. So it's been a lot of fun.
Well, and I'd love to dig in even deeper on that relationship with Peter McCormick, because of course his experience at ExactTarget brought a ton of value in terms of industry knowledge and industry connections. But one of the things that comes through to me, Clint, as I'm talking to you, is you are very well spoken. You clearly care about your team and you care about becoming better as a leader. What are some of the things that you learned from Peter and his advice as your mentor as you've grown Emma these last couple of years?
With every bit of advice from Peter, I mentioned the fact that he said, look, you know, I think there's some things that we could add to this team that would really propel us forward, right? And just some things that we sort of haven't quite gotten to yet. But with every bit of advice along those lines, he was always quick to say, but you know what? We have to hold on to the essence of Emma. Whatever changes we make, whatever new people we might bring in, either as employees or advisors or what have you, he's like, there's something special in the heart of this. And ultimately, you know it better than me or anyone else, and we need to hold on to that. So if I'm ever giving you advice that steers us off course in that way, or if anything we're doing feels like it pulls us away from that, then let's stop and think for a minute, because He's like, if anything, I want to make sure that this remains, you know, the thing that you guys have created and maintains the heart and sort of soul that you guys have spent so much time infusing it with. So I really took that to heart. But he's someone I can turn to. We talked actually a couple of hours ago. I can ask the strategic questions. I can ask people questions. I can ask, what do you think about, you know, communicating this part of the plan or making sure that I'm staying close enough to my colleagues now that we're nearing 200 people. So it's a little bit of all of it. And what makes Peter extra special is that he's also lived a great life outside of work, and he's lived abroad with his family, something that we aspire to, you know, down the road. And he sort of brings really a holistic sort of life. He's almost a life coach more than just a business coach, which is incredibly powerful, right? Because it's all kind of the same, right? Particularly for entrepreneurs, for founders, right? Who are trying to balance this group of people they're responsible for at work and this other little group of people they're also kind of responsible for at home. And people sort of, you know, at work who are also crossing the friend lines in the best way possible. And it's just there's a lot there. And so the lines blur in a beautiful way when you do it right. And Peter is able, I think, to help me look at it in that respect, too.
That's really cool that you were able to find him as a mentor and get as much out of that relationship as you have. It clearly shows with the way that Emma is growing right now. You've got a team of 200-plus people all over the country. What are some of the things you're doing to keep pace at an innovation level? It's such a crowded space right now. I mean, I know you guys have a good chunk of that space, but it seems like more and more entrants coming into the market, bigger and bigger budgets behind some of the existing companies. How do you continue to innovate and gain traction as a company that comparatively hasn't raised as much money as a lot of the other email companies out there?
That's right. Well, you know, and it's a crowded space for a reason. You know, digital marketing is only going to go up from here and get bigger. And when you think about the channels within digital marketing that matter most, every conversation starts with email, right? As the channel that's proven year over year to continue to be the most effective way, not just to reach your customers, but to get them to act, right? And so we always have to start there and remind ourselves that it is a crowded space because there's so much value here for marketers and their teams and the brands behind them. And so it's a thrilling space to be a part of. We said at one point along the way, said, you know what, if we're gonna be in this vibrant marketplace that's fast moving and challenging and exciting, and like you said, there are all sorts of competitors, all sorts of sizes and all sorts of flavors, particularly when you fan out across different verticals and industries, right? And three new people pop up on the map, right? Light up. So it's all that. So like the way we're gonna win is if we're a little bit agnostic to about the pace of people around us, and we're keeping pace ourselves, and we're embracing that fast motion, right, and that pace of innovation. I'm really excited about the changes that we've started to make at a product level. We brought in a lot of talented folks to the software team, product and engineering together, and we've now gotten on a cadence because we've matured a lot as a software organization over the last few years, where we're essentially on a monthly cadence of product release. Every 30 days right now, we are releasing a meaningful enhancement to the product offering. And it's things like, so far this year, we've rolled out A/B content testing. So subject line testing is a great place to start. What about the rest of the email campaign? And how can you test a few things and ultimately let your audience tell you which one they prefer? We've rolled out a marketing calendar, right? So you can manage and schedule your email campaigns and over time start to add other things to that marketing mix as well. And the calendar sounds like a small thing, but for marketers, I know it's a huge thing. Every marketer has a calendar on the wall, on the whiteboard, in, you know, Google Docs, in whatever it is, and probably some of all of those things, right? The calendar is the centerpiece of where the plans and the schedules come together, and it's a really nice thing for our customers to use. And then we don't have to just stop at email, because the more central we become in terms of the product that we're offering and experience there, and also the integrations that we offer beyond that, there's more and more that can happen in that calendar and in your Emma account. An example of that is the product we released at Marketing United. It's the first time we've launched something in the middle of the conference, and it's a landing pages product.
Oh, wow.
Now we step out of email into web a little bit so that we can continue that thought and get beyond the open and the click and get all the way to the visit to the form fill, to the download, right? And everything that spins off of that, from your welcome email series that gets triggered to follow-up email campaigns and all the rest of it. And you can use the same exact editor tools that you love to use with them for your email campaigns to create now those web pages behind them. And so for marketing teams that, you know, struggle to get the IT team's attention to crack open the big website and add a page or add a series of pages in a timely manner for that campaign they've got to launch in the next week or two, now we're putting more tools squarely in the hands of the marketers themselves. And so we're just on a really good cadence, and we've got some incredible things planned for summer and fall. We actually now, before we make a public release, we have what our marketing team calls a release rally. And we've got one coming up tomorrow where everybody inside the Emma walls and virtually comes together for an hour-long celebration of the release that's about to happen, the ins and outs of everything and how it works. All the teams by that point have been trained on it. The sales folks know what to do with it. Customer support folks know how to support it. And it's just a chance to stop and celebrate for a minute before we turn the lights on for our customer base.
That sounds like a really cool cultural sort of experience for the brand and the team there. And I imagine gets everyone aligned around it pre-launch. And are you doing Steve Jobs style product announcements now?
Well, you know, I do have the radio voice for it, but right. not the black turtleneck or the hipster glasses or the IQ for that matter. So there's some things we're still working on over here. But I have some colleagues who might have the turtleneck in the wardrobe and do a really good job of that. And so I think you're right. We're increasingly attuned to making sure that by the time we put something out in the world, everyone here has been a part of it, right? Of designing it, of giving feedback on it. You know, building it, reviewing it, preparing the documentation for it, all of that good stuff. And you're right, it just serves to get everybody first and foremost aware, right, which is key, because when you're moving at on a monthly cadence, right, that's a lot of movement, right, over a short period of time. And so to make sure that all those moving pieces and parts are squared away and every team feels good and comfortable and confident ahead of time is huge. You know, so that's a huge benefit. And then you're right, just on top of that, once that's all done, then you can take a breath and just get really fired up. And when it rolls out to customers, you can be excited about the experience that they're about to have. So it's absolutely a big cultural thing for us. And again, to your earlier question, right, it reminds us that we are innovating in a huge way at a really fast pace. And if there's something our customers want from us and we don't quite have it, well, it probably won't be long before we do. And it just gives us a ton of confidence as we look out over the next year or two and think about what we have a chance to do to support this community and the kind of partnerships we'll be able to create and all the things we'll be able to help marketers accomplish together. So it's been a fun, it's kind of monthly event to start to host internally. And of course, you know, we've learned our snack lesson, so there are always snacks. You know, release rally, it's going to be donuts and some other form of pastries. And in fact, we had a little bit of fun with the A/B content release rally, and we did our own little A/B test, and the marketing team set out donuts and bagels. And of course, you can probably imagine which of those ended up winning the A/B test. We'll try to spruce up the bagels tray next time a little bit more and see if we can give them a little bit more of an edge. But people love donuts.
It's all about the cream cheese, man. It's all about the cream cheese.
You know, you may be right. Yeah, maybe it's the cream cheese platter next to the bagel platter that wasn't quite up to snuff the first time. So
people just start putting cream cheese on their donuts, though.
that's true. Well, dogs and cats living together. You never know what's going to happen at a release rally.
That's true, especially in Nashville.
That's right.
Well, I'm really looking forward to getting back down to Nashville, and I hope I can come and check out the magic that you've got going on there at Emma, maybe even grab a snack while I'm there. In the meantime, where can people find you and connect with you online, Clint?
You can check our website out at myemma.com, and I'm just Clint, C-L-I-N-T. At myemma.com, and I would welcome anyone emailing and finishing the conversation or just continuing online. Happy to do that.
Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. Are you on Twitter or any other social platforms?
I'm lightly on Twitter, barely on Facebook. So the email is probably the best way to initiate something with me. So.
I hear email's not going anywhere.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, cool. Thank you so much.
Matt, it's been great. Really, really appreciate it. Thanks.
Likewise.
Hey, thanks for listening and hanging out with us through this whole interview. Make sure you check out another episode. That's episode 13 of Powder Keg Igniting Startups. And that's with the serial entrepreneur and investor, Jay Baer. Jay helped connect me with Clint for this episode and has a wealth of information to share in his own interview. So check it out. I really think you're going to like it. And for more stories on entrepreneurs, leaders, and top talent outside of Silicon Valley, subscribe to us on iTunes at powderkeg.com/iTunes. You'll want to subscribe because we have some great guests coming up, so don't miss it. We've also got a helpful companion website at powderkeg.com. You're going to find show notes there with all the links and contact information we mentioned in the episode, as well as some other useful articles and interviews from the Powder Keg community. So thanks for listening, and you'll be hearing from us real soon.